welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 13th, 2021. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo. From the front page of today's Gazette, Black students in CR face alarming disparity. Fate of resource officers debated as racial gap in crime allegations grows, by Grace King of the Gazette. Black students in the Cedar Rapids district are far more likely to have allegations of criminal wrongdoing made against them than are white students, and the disparity has been worsening, according to newly available data from Iowa's Department of Human Rights. Black students made up 61.2% of the criminal allegations, including simple, serious, and aggravated misdemeanors and felonies, in Cedar Rapids schools between 2015 and 2020, while making up only 19.1% of the district student population, according to the data. White students are 60.4% of the student body in Cedar Rapids schools, but account for only a minority of the criminal allegations. Assault causing bodily injury, theft, criminal mischief, reckless use of fire or explosives, harassment, possession of a controlled substance, sexual abuse, and robbery are examples of serious misdemeanors, aggravated misdemeanors, or felony arrests over the past 3 years. "We're definitely disappointed and actually hurt," said Nicole Kuiker, deputy superintendent for the Cedar Rapids Community School District. "This data is alarming, and we need to acknowledge that. I think that what's critical is that we're listening and willing to make whatever changes we need to make, sure we're not perpetuating harm to students." That alarming data is fueling impetus for the district to re-examine the school resource officer program that puts uniformed police officers inside 7 Cedar Rapids schools. The vast majority of the allegations against students arise from the school-based officers. The State Department of Human Rights data, obtained by the Gazette, is being shared with school board members in a presentation by students and district officials at 5 p.m. Monday during the regular school board meeting. According to the state data about the district, Black students ran 6.24 times the risk of having a complaint made against them than white students during the 2019-20 academic year. Overall, 69% of complaints were made against Black students compared with 29% made against white students during that school year. Complaints against Black students increased 50% compared with white students, which decreased by 6.1% between the 2015-16 and 2019 school years, the figures show. Overall complaints in the schools increased 22.9% over a 5-year period. The district is considering how the school officers could potentially be used differently or what other support schools would need if they were removed altogether. "Our high schools aren't going to look the same next year," Kuiker said. "It's not even an option. The data tells us it's not an option. I don't need any more data metrics to know the system isn't currently working." The school resource officer program was piloted in the Cedar Rapids district in January 2010 at Jefferson High School. A year later, it was expanded to Kennedy and Washington High Schools. Today, school resource officers are at Jefferson High, Kennedy High, Washington High, Metro, Polk Alternative High, and Roosevelt and McKinley Middle Schools. Kuiker said there was no specific reason the officers initially were added to the district, and there is no good answer about why they were later added to only 2 of the middle schools. The district is considering removing school resource officers from middle schools next year or rotating them between the 6 Cedar Rapids middle schools. "Next year, the plan is not to just have a school resource officer at Roosevelt and McKinley, for sure," Kuiker said. Kuiker said the district is prepared to take serious action this summer. "We know kids will not come back through the doors of our schools with this looking the same," she said. The district has an agreement for the school resource officer program with the city of Cedar Rapids. The last contract was approved April 27, 2020 by the school board. It funds 7 police officer positions to the Cedar Rapids district, a cost of $1,905,198 over the 2-year contract period ending June 30, 2022. The contract allows either the school district or police department to provide a 30-day written notice to end the agreement. "All options are on the table," Kuiker said. The contract states that the school district will be provided monthly data from the school resource officer program, but this has not been happening since the inception of the program at Cedar Rapids Schools, an oversight by both the district and the police department, Kuiker said. "The data the schools do receive is combined with information from the College Community School District and Kirkwood Community Colleges, which also use the school resource officer program through the Cedar Rapids Police Department." The latest conversation about school resource officers began with Kennedy High students Rama and Rafa El Sheik, who asked for removal of the officers in Black Lives Matter demands to the school board in July 2020. While the El Sheik sisters graduated this year, the fight to remove school resource officers is being picked up by other students, including Will C. Coley, 17, who will be a senior this fall at Kennedy High. She will be one of a few students to present to the school board Monday with the support of district officials. Coley said she was not surprised by the data from the Iowa Department of Human Rights. "We saw this coming," she said. "We know people who were targeted by school resource officers, specifically Black students." Coley said her goal is to see removal of the officers. "We should not be trying to build relationships with the school resource officers," she said. "Some students have been traumatized by the police, especially with seeing the deaths of our brothers and sisters on TV and social media." Coley said she wants to see the money spent on mental health professionals and educators instead. Kuiker, the deputy superintendent, said that there should always be at least one go-to adult within a building, whether that's a cook, secretary, paraeducator, teacher, or principal, that every kid has a close connection to. Before the end of this school year, at the urging of students, the district sent a survey to students about the program. It asked questions including, "Do you feel school resource officers are needed in our schools? Have you witnessed a difference in how school resource officers discipline students of color versus white students? Have you witnessed school resource officers effectively prevent violence in schools?" Students were able to rate how safe and welcome they feel around the officers and share any of their experiences. The data collected by this survey was not available to the Gazette, but will be shared Monday with the school board. Kuiker said she was surprised and disappointed by the data collected from the surveys. "We're acknowledging as a district that we need to make some serious changes to how we operate in schools with our school resource officer program," she said. "What that looks like, I'm not sure, but there's definitely alarming data we're acknowledging." Kuiker said the district's discipline data, specifically suspensions, are disproportionate as well. "We need to dig into our practices as an educational system. We want to make sure we provide systems of support that do not perpetuate more harm," Kuiker said. Officers with the Cedar Rapids Police Department say removing school resource officers would be a mistake. Captain Brent Long, who oversees the Community Service Division, including school resource officers, said the school officers are about more than law enforcement. They become friends with the students. School resource officers can be informal counselors, step into classrooms for quick lessons in driver's education, government and law classes, and provide law enforcement and safety at school. School resource officers also operate a diversion program. A student who is pushing and shoving another student in the hallway might be tasked with writing a paper and turning that into the officer instead of being charged, Long said. In 2019, the diversion program was expanded beyond disorderly conduct and now includes criminal mischief, trespassing, small amounts of marijuana, vape pens, and alcohol. School resource officers also refer students to mental health counselors or community resources, such as the Area Substance Abuse Council or food pantries. Lieutenant Matt Wells, who oversees school resource officers at Jefferson High, Roosevelt Middle School, College Community, and Kirkwood, said officers aren't there to arrest students. "If there's a fight in the lunchroom, there's a fight in the lunchroom, and whoever participates is going to get charged with disorderly conduct," he said. Veronica Fowler, communications director with the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa, said tracking school resource officer data can demonstrate that despite good intention, school resource officers have caused incredible harm to some students, especially students of color. Fowler said, "While police departments may tout the good relationships the officers build with students, it's not a healthy relationship for these students to be having. School resource officers escalate situations that could otherwise be resolved by teachers, school counselors, or mental health professionals," Fowler said. "Police can be helpful, but police are not your friend," Fowler said. "Their job is to keep the peace and arrest people. It's one reason globally we are asking we reimagine public safety." "School officers are a failed experiment," Fowler said. "They were born out of a concern over school shootings, but there's no indication school resource officers can reduce the likelihood of a mass shooting," Fowler said. "Instead, what we do know can help its mental health resources." Also from the front page of today's Gazette, Iowa job postings are mostly in cities. 6 counties have more than other 93 counties combined. By John Stepp of the Gazette. As Iowans' participation in federal unemployment benefits ends, state officials have pointed to the number of job postings in the state, over 68,000, as evidence for the need to stop payments. "Today we have more job openings than we have people on unemployment," Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday in Coralville at the Iowa Association of Business and Industries annual conference. "Those job openings, however, are especially condensed in urban areas and not necessarily in industries that brought the most unemployment claims during the pandemic," according to a Gazette analysis of Iowa workforce development data. 6 counties, Polk, Lynn, Johnson, Scott, Blackhawk, and Dubuque, have more job openings than Iowa's 93 other counties combined as of Wednesday's figures. Those counties account for 40% of Iowa's population. The urban-rural difference is especially stark in eastern Iowa. Lynn County has 2,510 job openings per 100,000 people. But its neighbor to the east, Jones County, has only 914 job openings per 100,000 people, and its westerly neighbor, Benton County, has 717 per 100,000 people. Dave Swenson, an Iowa State University economist, attributed the urban-rural gap to rural areas not relying as heavily on industries that were hit hard by the pandemic. "Dining, drinking, those kinds of things, they're not a mainstay of rural economies," Swenson noted. "Now many of the sectors that disproportionately hit urban areas are recovering," he added during a phone interview. "Manufacturing and construction usually have been two of the largest sources of new unemployment claims each week in Iowa. but those sectors have a relatively small chunk of the 68,295 advertised job openings. Manufacturing accounts for about 6.6% of job openings, and construction comes in at 1.9%. 25 counties had 5 or fewer manufacturing job postings, and 64 counties had 5 or fewer construction job postings. Healthcare and social assistance, on the other hand, was another large source of unemployment claims and had a large share of job openings, about 17%. That demand will remain strong for many years as baby boomers age, Swenson said. About a quarter of healthcare and social assistance job postings are in Polk and Linn counties, the two most populated counties in the state. The 2,869 combined job postings between those counties is more than 77 other counties in Iowa combined. There has been a systematic shift in employment away from non-metro to metro in the healthcare sector, Swenson said. Some Republicans and business groups have expressed optimism that the cutoff in federal unemployment benefits will help fill some of the state's advertised job openings. State Senator Waylon Brown, Republican Osage, said axing the extra $300 per week from the federal pandemic unemployment compensation is one of the things necessary to get the economy back up and going and get people back into that workforce. When you look at the amount of jobs that are out there right now, it may not be in the field that you would like to be working in, but there are plenty of jobs out there, Brown said. A May survey by the Iowa Restaurant Association indicated almost 90% of restaurant operators believe the federal unemployment programs were the primary reason for challenges hiring enough staff. But State Senator Bill Dotzler, Democrat Waterloo, described the cutoff of benefits as a major mistake. The worker shortage in Iowa doesn't have to do with people sitting at home collecting unemployment benefits, Dotzler said. The real issue is we don't have enough workers in Iowa, and the policies are driving more and more talented, educated people out of the state. Swenson also is skeptical of the idea that stopping the federal benefits could help Iowa businesses. That's not going to have any impact on the number of job postings, Swenson said. He actually expects Reynolds' decision to have the opposite effect on Iowa's economy. That's a lot of money that would have been consumed in our economy, Swenson said. It will lower the level of household consumption, lower the demand for goods and services over that few months that they've cut this out, and it will have a negative effect, economic effect, on the overall economy. And also, Iowa reports 127 new COVID cases, nearly 44.5% of Iowa residents fully vaccinated, by Sierra Hoger of the Gazette. Iowa reported 127 new positive COVID-19 cases for the previous 24 hours as of 1:30 p.m. Saturday, according to data from the Iowa Department of Public Health and as analyzed by the Gazette. 20 of those new cases were for children under the age of 18. 10 new cases were reported in Linn County, while 9 new cases were recorded in Johnson County. 2 confirmed deaths also were recorded statewide, one within the 61 to 80 age range and the other within the 41 to 60 age group. Of the deaths reported, one was from December and the other in May of this year. The total number of individuals who have died in connection with the novel coronavirus since March 2020 is listed at 6,099. The New York Times reported 599,520 deaths nationwide as of midday Saturday. As of 1:30 p.m. Saturday, 43.42% of all Iowans, or 1,370,031 individuals, were fully vaccinated. A total of 1,307,329 Iowans have received a two-shot dosage of either the Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna vaccine, while 116,816 residents have completed a one-shot dosage of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In Linn County, 49.4%, or 111,984 residents, have been fully vaccinated. In Johnson County, 55.16%, or 83,362 residents, have received the full series of vaccines. The number of hospitalizations increased by 8 from Friday, bringing the total to 81. 19 patients were in intensive care, and 7 were on ventilators. 4 long-term care facilities in Iowa still are experiencing outbreaks, with 31 individuals, residents or staff members, testing positive for coronavirus. As of Saturday at 1:30 p.m., 2,369 individuals connected to long-term care facilities have died as a result of COVID-19. The Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. In the news, refugee children brought to Iowa. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' office said 19 refugee children were flown to Des Moines and transported to sponsor families last month, despite her previous rejection of a federal request that immigrant children be housed in Iowa. Reynolds' office said the federal government on multiple occasions denied the April 22nd flight was part of a federal refugee settlement program, but on May 21st confirmed that it was. Reynolds said she and Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, both Republicans, have joined Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley's call for a U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on immigration issues at the U.S.-Mexico border. Refugee children also were recently settled in Tennessee. dry Iowa. Nearly 90% of Iowa is experiencing some degree of drought, according to the latest weather summary update issued by a coalition of state and federal agencies. Iowa's statewide average precipitation totaled 3.71 inches in May, or 1.13 inches below normal. A big winner. Iowa lottery officials said a Mega Millions ticket purchased at Barry's Mini Mart convenience store in Harper's Ferry is worth a $1 million payout to the owner. The ticket came within one number of having a share of the $56 million jackpot. Marketing Iowa. Governor Kim Reynolds said she will use pandemic relief funds on a marketing campaign to persuade people to move to Iowa, a state that has a job surplus and has lifted COVID-19 restrictions more quickly than other states. They said, while there is an opportunity for increased revenue, this decision was based on enhancing the fan experience and providing an additional amenity to our fans. That was University of Iowa Athletic Director Gary Barta on the expansion of alcohol sales at athletic events. And everybody else kind of faltered coming in, unfortunately for those, but fortunately for me. That was PGA Champions Tour golfer Stephen Ames after winning the Principal Charity Classic in Des Moines. Some odds and ends. A fleet update. The Iowa Transportation Commission approved more than $7 million in federal funding for 78 new public transit vehicles and 21 different public transit systems that will replace vehicles past their useful life. State settlements. The state agreed to pay $5.7 million to offer compensation for or settle 8 separate accusations of discrimination and negligence at its public universities. New wardens. The appointments of new wardens at correctional facilities in Anamosa and Fort Dodge have been approved by the Iowa Board of Corrections. And some water cooler notes. Earmarks return. After a 10-year ban on congressional earmarks, Iowa's U.S. House members seek more than $51 million for projects ranging from expanding child care centers to modernizing Mississippi River locks and dams. Vaccine campaign. The Iowa Department of Public Health launched a multimedia marketing campaign to inform more Iowans about the benefits of the COVID-19 vaccine and to encourage them to get vaccinated. And crops emerging. Iowa farmers have planted most of their corn and soybean acres, with much of the 2021 crop now emerged and growing. And more in the news, GOP leaders back Iowa caucuses. State party leaders in the 4 early voting states released a joint statement expressing their support for the presidential nominating calendar to remain the same, including Iowa's first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses. In order, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina cast the first choices for president every 4 years. Democrats are weighing potential changes to that early voting calendar, threatening Iowa's first-in-the-nation status, at least on the Democratic side. Nevada recently approved legislation that would move its primary to first in the nation, although the National Party would need to act before that became a reality. Divisive topics. Iowa schools, public colleges, and government entities cannot teach so-called divisive concepts, including that moral character is determined by one's race or sex, or that the United States and Iowa are fundamentally or systematically racist, under legislation signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds. Traffic deaths. So far this year, at least 119 people have died in traffic crashes on Iowa highways, a total up more than 25% from the death toll of 95 for the same period 1 year ago. Last month's toll of 41 traffic deaths was the highest in May in 9 years. And roads budget. Iowa transportation officials are expecting a fairly status quo highway improvement program over the next 5-year planning period, with about $3.6 billion targeted toward projects aimed at enhancing safety and modernizing and maintaining Iowa's current network of roadways. Turning to the Insight page, Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column, we can't enforce our way to zero fatalities. A troubling traffic safety trend emerged during the COVID-19 pandemic. While the number of vehicles on the road dropped sharply, road fatalities did not decline in tandem. Data in Iowa and elsewhere show speed increased last year, and there is anecdotal evidence that distracted driving rose as well, fueling a rise in traffic deaths that seems to be continuing even as the pandemic is on its way out. The state patrol chief called it the most dangerous driving we've witnessed in our 85-year history. More people were working from home, staying safe, and reducing travel. This should have been a recipe for less traffic crashes and traffic fatalities. But instead, Iowa actually saw an increase in traffic fatalities in 2020 from the previous year, said Patrick Hoy, leader of the governor's Traffic Safety Bureau. The state recently launched a campaign intended to reduce fatal crashes with a goal of fewer than 300 in 2021. Traffic safety is supposed to be based on the 3 E's, engineering, enforcement, and education. But Iowa leaders are leaning heavily on just one of those, enforcement. At a news conference announcing the statewide traffic crackdown, organizers filled the Capitol steps in Des Moines with uniformed police officers wearing their brimmed hats, not with traffic engineers and public relations professionals. I guess that makes for a better photo opportunity. Police departments across the state this past week coordinated a special enforcement project aimed at impaired drivers. They have plans for other campaigns this summer focused on speeding, seatbelts, and distracted driving. It's a common instinct to throw more law enforcement resources at a perceived problem, and it's often not the best solution, especially if it's the only solution being taken up. Last year's pandemic driving trends highlighted an important but overlooked truth about traffic safety. Drivers operate according to the conditions around them, not necessarily to the posted speed limit or enforcement schemes. With more people staying home to practice social distancing, drivers were greeted by wide-open roads with little opposing traffic, which made them comfortable driving faster and paying less attention to the road. Certainly, the roads looked a lot different at that time when there was a lot less traffic volume on the roads, Iowa Department of Transportation Director Scott Marler said. We could put that insight to good use and build roads that promote safe driving. Common street designs in Iowa with wide visibility lend themselves to higher speeds, which in turn necessitates more police. While traffic planners made passing reference this past week to roadway configuration and signage, they are mostly focused on enforcement. Pulling drivers over and issuing tickets, especially in high visibility areas, is associated with fewer vehicle accidents, but it has diminishing returns. In other words, policing can have some beneficial effect on safety, but we can't enforce our way to zero fatalities. Traffic stops also have drawbacks. Petty enforcement foments resentment of police among the public. People of color in Iowa are more likely to be pulled over, reinforcing the criticism that policing is racially biased. Sending salaried employees out to enforce traffic laws is also expensive. Investing in smarter road design could be cheaper in the long run. Additionally, any confrontation between police and the public has the possibility of turning deadly. The city of Manchester was hit with a lawsuit last month accusing a police officer of recklessly killing an Iowa man in a 2020 traffic pursuit. Last December, a police initiated a chase of a motorcyclist for speeding and having a suspended license, according to the Gazette journalist Trish Mahaffey's reporting on the lawsuit. A state trooper and a sheriff's deputy ended the pursuit because it was unsafe within city limits, but a Manchester police officer continued the chase. The man they were pursuing, Augustin Mormon, was killed after Officer James Wessel's police vehicle came into contact with the motorcycle. The lawsuit claims Wessel's intentionally killed Mormon. Running a high-speed chase through town certainly doesn't make Iowans safer. Speeding is bad, but it should not carry a death sentence unilaterally carried out by a cop. And Todd Dorman's 24-hour Dorman column, Bright Light of Oversight Dimmed at State House. Rumor has it that both the Iowa House and Senate have government oversight committees. Turns out the rumor is true, although there was little evidence of their existence during the 2021 legislative session that ended last month. Ideally, government oversight committees oversee and investigate government decision-making, especially by executive branch agencies. Maybe you've heard of checks and balances. For example, government oversight panels might seek to understand how the governor's office spent or misspent federal COVID-19 aid. Or maybe the committees could explore the decision to turn down $95 million in federal dollars for surveillance testing in schools. The oversight committees might be curious how Test Iowa performed after the governor awarded a large no-bid contract to Ashton Kutcher's Utah Buds. State Representative Chuck Eisenhardt, Democrat Dubuque, a House Oversight Committee member, asked Chair Representative Holly Brink in April to convene an oversight hearing to assess the state's future capacity for infectious disease prevention and response and local public health needs. Eisenhardt requested, to the extent possible, the inquiry should appraise the roles of the General Assembly, the governor, and the county boards of health, as well as the federal government, as they employed their respective powers and responsibilities during the pandemic. Sounds like a good idea. After all, the legislature basically allowed Republican Governor Kim Reynolds to run Iowa's entire pandemic response, or lack thereof. As a co-equal branch of state government, GOP legislative leaders should be interested in assessing what went right and wrong. Hundreds of thousands of Iowans were sickened, and more than 6,000 died. It's among the toughest challenges ever faced by the state, and what if it happens again? But Eisenhardt's request has yet to even be acknowledged. That's not a big surprise. Republicans who run the Golden Dome of Wisdom and the oversight committees also dismissed requests for lawmakers to delve into the other pandemic issues listed above. Instead, the bright light of oversight was shown on other matters. On January 27th, according to the legislature's website, the House delved into the case of a University of Iowa dental student who was called for a disciplinary hearing after defending President Donald Trump's executive order banning certain types of diversity training. The committee held three meetings on the incident. University officials eventually apologized and admitted the case had been mishandled. On March 9th, the House Government Oversight Committee used its final meeting of the session to spend 2 hours blasting Ames school district officials for holding a Black Lives Matter at School Week of Action. Republicans on the panel were, in particular, incensed by a document detailing the racist motivations behind voting changes. One lawmaker called it garbage. Others might call it American history repeating itself. As for the Senate Government Oversight Committee, Democrats urge majority Republicans to investigate, among other COVID issues, serious problems with coronavirus data reporting, the firing of a Department of Public Health staffer who provided public information to a reporter, and the decision to keep the state's COVID-19 vaccine advisory committee meetings closed to the public. Instead, the committee met just once on January 12th to adopt rules. First rule, apparently, don't meet again. Not to belittle the importance of campus speech rights for conservatives and the continuing plight of offended lawmakers, okay, maybe I am belittling that second one, but it seems like there might have been some bigger fish to fry with regard to oversight. Unfortunately, Republicans are far more interested in battering their enemies and protecting the governor than making sure our government is functioning properly as it addressed the small matters of life and death. Would Democrats have used hearings to score their own political points? Of course, but that's no excuse for basically abandoning the legislature's oversight duties. With the GOP trifecta, accountability has all but disappeared. Government oversight has been fitted with partisan blinders. Republican lawmakers skip legislative forums, dodge reporters, snub editorial boards, and avoid virtually any setting where they might be questioned on how they're running the state. Only supporters, friendly special interests, and of course donors can make it inside the bubble. When you only listen to a few people, you end up passing legislation that harms a lot of people. And when you abandon oversight, it can, and likely will, come back to haunt you. If we aren't holding ourselves responsible for the performance of state government, others will do it for us. It won't be pretty, and our knee-jerk reactions probably won't result in the most thoughtful improvements, Eisenhart said in an email. Oversight committees are permitted to meet in the interim between sessions, so there's still time to delve into these issues. And it could snow on Independence Day. Anything is possible. And turning to the community letters, and also the editorial cartoon from editorial cartoonist Joe Heller of Green Bay, we see Blue Origin rocket ship in space with Jeff Bezos looking out the window. The world's richest man plans to travel to space. And Jeff Bezos is looking out the window at Earth in the distance, and he says, before I buy something, I always like to see it. The first letter today is from Ken Wetgen of Cathedral City, California. Hinson's alternative facts missed the mark. The Sunday Gazette published an article concerning earmark spending. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson said she is fighting for investments that Iowa needs or allowing Speaker Nancy Pelosi to send this money to projects in San Francisco. Hinson also was quoted saying, coastal elites don't need any more of Iowa's taxpayer dollars. I wasn't going to allow this money to go to California instead of being invested in Iowa. California is one of 11 states that subsidize federal spending in Iowa. Iowa is one of 39 states that takes more than it gives. For example, California's balance of payments is minus $13.7 billion. This means California residents get less in return than what they pay. However, Iowa has a balance of payments of $2.5 billion more in federal services than what Iowans pay in taxes. The difference per capita means in California, each resident is sending in $348 more than they get back. In Iowa, each resident is receiving $797 more back in federal services than they pay in taxes. These numbers can be easily verified by reading Insider magazine. Insider is a nonpartisan business and financial magazine. I would like to think if California was not subsidizing states like Iowa, we could better use the money to take care of homeless and lower our state taxes. That was Ken Wetgen of Cathedral City, California. The next letter is from Kathleen Noyd of Cedar Rapids. School staff underpaid and unappreciated. History repeats itself. Paraeducators, secretaries, associates, payroll and accounting clerks have been denied a decent livable wage again in the Cedar Rapids Community School District. I was a payroll clerk at the Early Educational Support Center for 13 years. Our bargaining unit fell into an agreement for a so-called raise of 7 cents an hour. Despite opposition, our union voted for the degrading, dismal new raise for the following contract year. For shame. The same is true even today. Hourly staff are underpaid, overworked, and not appreciated. If paras and hourly staff are the heart and soul of education, adjust that unspent balance of $18 million for a fair rate of pay for all. Kathleen Noyd of Cedar Rapids. Next, Peggy Stover of Cedar Rapids writes, Hinson's town hall full of misinformation. I've had several meetings with U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson's Cedar Rapids staff to determine why she voted against a bill to protect healthcare workers from violence, H.R. 1195. Her staff has been cordial during visits and follow-up emails. I also attended her recent town hall. Violence against healthcare workers is rampant and receives scant media attention. Nationally, 75% of the estimated 25,000 annual workplace assaults are against them. 47% of emergency room physicians and 30% of nurses have been assaulted by patients. Hinson seemed stumped when asked about H.R. 1195, so I provided a synopsis and stats. She said, many bills that are voted on don't go through committees, and this is probably one of them. The bill had provisions in it, which I did not agree with. When pressed for specifics, she answered with illogical chatter on voting procedures. Public records show it was discussed in the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. And unlike what she stated, major bills such as H.R. 1195 are required to be assigned to a committee before they can be voted on. Her misinformation continued when a gentleman asked about another bill, H.R. 5, that he called the hate speech bill. Hinson agreed with his categorization. It was clear neither knew that H.R. 5, the Equality Act, would expand the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1968 Fair Housing Act to protect LGBTQ individuals from discrimination. Hinson is an ex-journalist who should know the importance of facts versus misinformation. That was Peggy Stover of Cedar Rapids. The next letter is from Gordon Taylor of Anamosa. Rational Republicans do still exist. I was deeply moved by the column by Norman Sherman in the June 3rd edition of the Gazette. I consider myself an independent voter with a tendency to go left, although in today's political climate I tend to go hard left. I've always advocated for a two-party system and have voted Republican more than once. The existence of a call for American renewal, as discussed in the column and its reference to the many notable and respected participants, is a clear sign that there is a sensible and sane alternative to the insanity prevalent within the existing Republican Party. I hope they can draft and support primary candidates to counter the spineless and radical members of the current Republican Party. Depending on the candidate, I might even vote Republican during the primary just to get rid of a current Republican. That might be food for thought. Gordon Taylor of Anamosa. And the final letter from Tom Woodruff of North Liberty is free speech training required at universities. Who would have ever thought our educators of higher learning, at institutions in the state of Iowa would be required to take special training related to understanding and teaching free speech? This is absolutely unbelievable. You have to start by asking yourself who the majority of these educators politically support, and do they even meet their own standards for diversity they expect from others? This answer is obvious. They don't. The future? Vote, continue to expose this kind of destructive free speech opposition, and take away certain financial support. Thanks to the Board of Regents, at least in Iowa, for their actions. Many of us now know why you would never wear a certain political hat on any of those campuses and why our political signs keep getting stolen. Tom Woodruff of North Liberty. You were listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 13th, 2021, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn now to the obituaries. And the other notices, Robert H. Campbell, age 77, of Hawkeye, died Thursday, June 10th. Becker & Son Funeral Home in Hawkeye is taking care of arrangements. And Garnet Higgins, age 81, of Monticello, died Thursday, June 10th, and Getch Funeral Home of Monticello handling arrangements. Linda Wilderman Batchelder, age 75, of Deep River, Ontario, Canada, formerly of Cedar Rapids, was born on August 1945 in Cedar Rapids. On Tuesday, June 1st, Linda left this world after many years of kidney dialysis. She was a beautician both in Iowa and Canada. She spent her youth in Cedar Rapids, met her husband in Austria, and moved to his country, Canada. She lived in Canada for most of her life. Carl James Hoffman, age 84, of Cedar Rapids, passed away December 12, 2020 from complications of COVID-19. We invite you to join family and friends as we celebrate his life beginning at 11 a.m. Saturday, June 19th at New Covenant Bible Church, 3090 North Center Point Road, Cedar Rapids. Mary Ann Flick of Cedar Rapids was born in 1967 and passed away June 6, 2021 at home after a short illness. Mary Ann graduated from Kennedy High School in 1985. She participated in Special Olympics in the 1980s and won several ribbons in swimming and track. After high school, she worked for Options of Linn County for many years, as well as Goodwill and Mount Mercy University. There will be a celebration of life at a later date. Betty Ann Sass, née Peters, passed away Tuesday, May 18, 2021, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House. A visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Monday, June 14th, at Cedar Memorial Park Westside Chapel. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 15th, at Trinity Lutheran Church. Burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery will follow. Edward J. Hylers, age 78, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, May 30th, in his home. Funeral Mass will be 10 a.m. Friday, June 18th, at St. John 13 Catholic Church, with burial to follow in St. Patrick's Catholic Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 17th, at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. Ed enjoyed playing cards, watching the Hawkeyes, and was a proud supporter of Loras College and Duhawk Sports. He was actively involved in his grandchildren's activities and enjoyed completing daily word puzzles. Ed was a longtime member of the Knights of Columbus 909, as well as St. John 13th Catholic Church. He was awarded the Pride of Prairie for exemplary service to the College Community School District. In addition, Ed and Judy were Parents of the Year at Loras College in 1987. Judy Leiby, 87, of Olwine, passed away peacefully on Monday, June 7th. There will be a private visitation, followed by a public service at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Olwine on Friday, June 18th at 1 p.m. An interment will follow at Woodlawn Cemetery in Olwine. Judy was a proud member of her community. She served on the Mercy Hospital and Foundation Board of Directors, Mercy One Auxiliary, Old Wine Chamber of Commerce, and OCAD. She and her husband Wayne also served as ambassadors on the Plaza Board. Her fundraising committees included a new library, restoration of the Mealy Hotel, and Mercy Hospital. Deborah K. Voschel, age 48, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, June 10th at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital following complications of surgery. A celebration of Deborah's life is planned for a future date. Papich Cuba Funeral Service is serving the family. Although Deborah experienced many challenges in her life, she was always a loving sister, aunt, and great aunt. Donald Gene Plummer, September 18, 1946 to January 2, 2021. Please join us in celebration of life for Donald Dean Plummer, 74, of Fairfax. He was a man of character who never missed an occasion to get together with family and friends. We plan to honor his life from 1 to 5 p.m. Saturday, June 19th, at the Fairfax American Legion, 216 Main Street, Fairfax. A military service with military rights will be performed in his honor for U.S. Army service of duty in the Vietnam War and was a member of the Fairfax American Legion. Speakers will start at 1 p.m., followed by the military service. Let us not fill the room with sadness, but with joy and life full of memories, the happiness he brought to everyone. Juanita Ehrlich of Iowa City on Thursday, June 10th. Juanita Ehrlich, beloved wife, grandmother, sister, and friend, passed away. She was 84 years old. Juanita worked as a law clerk, librarian's assistant, secretary, and clerk. She had a smile for everyone, a determination that was infectious, and an eye for detail. Juanita loved garage sales and consignment shopping and usually found treasures that she would plan to give to someone else. Family was everything to Juanita. She especially enjoyed her grandchildren and grand fur babies. Juanita was intuitive, sometimes sensing that someone was having a difficult time and would call to offer support. She loved gathering with family and friends, helping others, hazelnut coffee, and watching Gunsmoke and Iowa Hawkeye sports. Ross A. Stickles, age 42, of Vinton, passed away at his home Wednesday, June 2nd, from natural causes. A memorial visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 15th, at Van Steenhuis Funeral Home in Vinton, Iowa. Ross was a sports fanatic. He enjoyed grilling and cooking and spending time with his dog Boots. But above all, Ross's pride and joy was his niece Tristan and his nephew Hunter. The Reverend Dr. K. Slocum Dillon of Cedar Rapids passed away peacefully on June 6, 2021, with loved ones at her side at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. A memorial service to celebrate her life will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, June 17th at First Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. Visitation with the family will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, June 16th at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. Pastor Kay stated that her goal was to be the Mother Teresa of Cedar Rapids, and she passionately and energetically embraced this goal. She endeavored to reach her congregation through personal and life-based examples in her sermons, and being an avid Star Trek fan, she often used content and life lesson material from episodes and wore a mock Star Trek communicator on her robe when using this content. She was proud to be living in Iowa, as this was the birthplace, in the year 2233, of James T. Kirk, captain of the Starship Enterprise in the original Star Trek series. In addition to having Mother Teresa as a role model, she aspired to the leadership model of Captain Catherine Janeway on the Starship Voyager. Robert James Thompson, known as Bob, age 90, died on September 10, 2020, in Mesa, Arizona. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, June 19th, at 11:30 a.m. at the Calvin Sinclair Presbyterian Church, 715 38th Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Terry Davis Conklin, age 79, of Milton, Georgia, formerly of Marion, passed away December 23, 2020. A memorial service will be held Saturday, June 19th at 2 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel. A reception will follow the service. Lyle Ratzel, 73, of Coralville, passed away on June 10th at his home following a long illness. A gathering in remembrance of Lyle will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 15th at the Kirkwood Room, 515 Kirkwood Avenue in Iowa City. Philip Nussbaum, age 67, of Iowa City, passed away unexpectedly at home on May 15, 2021. To celebrate his life and memory, a memorial gathering for Phil's family and friends will be held from 2 to 5:30 p.m. Saturday, June 19th, at the Kirkwood Room, 515 Kirkwood Avenue, Iowa City, where a brief memorial service will begin at 3 p.m. Philip was a gentle soul with a strong work ethic. He was always ready to lend a hand to coworkers, friends, and neighbors. He had a variety of interests throughout his life, a love for the Old West and John Wayne, fishing, music, home renovations, woodworking, Corvettes, and his dogs. Zeppa Mae Turner, age 82, of Marion, passed away on Friday, May 28th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. In accordance with her wishes, cremation has taken place. A private family graveside service will be held at Oakshade Cemetery in Marion. A celebration of Zeppa's life will take place from 3 to 5 p.m. Saturday, June 19th, at the home of Todd Turner, at 3155 Springville Road in Springville. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation in Marion is helping the family. Zepha was employed as a kitchen worker for the Marion School District, retiring in 2000, and was also a beautician. Zepha was a member of the Ascension Lutheran Church in Marion. She enjoyed reading and spending time with her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She will be missed by all who knew and loved her. Sandra L. Anderson, known as Sandy, age 76, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, May 11th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. on Friday, June 18th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, 4200 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Sandy enjoyed touring the United States with John in their RV, cooking for neighbors, church members, and family, and especially the time spent with her beloved family and friends. Sandy's greatest love with her was her grandchildren. She was so proud of them. Her memory will be cherished by all who knew and loved her. Sandy was a Christian woman who loved the Lord Jesus Christ above all. And Edward G. Polda Jr., age 76, known as Ed, of Troy, Missouri, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Friday, June 4th, at home, surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 18th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, 520 Wilson Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will be held at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, June 19th, at the funeral home. A live stream of the celebration of life may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Ed under photos and videos or media starting at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, June 19th. Ed enjoyed watching the Iowa Hawkeyes football and wrestling, listening and recording music, playing computer games, and driving his Ford F-150. He also enjoyed spending the winters in his beloved Arizona, fishing and spending time out in the desert, and bragging about his grandson, Austin Kleppy. Ed cherished the time spent with family and friends. He was never too busy to give a helping hand or whenever, wherever was needed. Turning to the sports page, my Klaus's column, Beer and Kinnick, brouhaha or something less. Don't look for beer and wine sales to make a significant change in atmosphere. Beer made for good coffee talk in Iowa last week. Iowa's athletic department announced it was expanding beer and wine sales at four of its athletic facilities, most notably Kinnick Stadium and Carver Hawkeye Arena, meaning it was opening them to the great unwashed instead of just the jewelry-rattling donors in the stadium suites. While there is an opportunity for increased revenue, this decision was based on enhancing the fan experience and providing an additional amenity to our fans, said Iowa Athletic Director Gary Barta. Yes, of course, it's all about giving, not taking. What can the Hawkeyes do for you, not you for them? That doesn't explain why all Kinnick's grandstand planks that offer so little personal space haven't been replaced by individual seats. How do you people sit like that for a few hours? The UI News release announcing beer and wine for the masses also contained this. 30% of net alcohol sales would be directed toward research-based initiatives developed and supported by the UI Alcohol Harm Reduction Committee, formed in 2009 to decrease high-risk drinking and the related harmful consequences. Just how selling alcoholic beverages in mass quantities is actually supportive of an alcohol harm reduction committee may be a mystery, but who are we to question such noble intentions? Look, the reality of beer in Kinnick is it isn't all that big a deal. I've been to Big Ten venues where beer was sold, and it didn't seem to have any effect on the crowd's behavior. For one thing, there are limits of how much you can buy at a time. For another, the drink isn't cheap. Stadium prices and the lines in which to wait to pay for them may discourage getting sloshed more than anything else at sporting events. From a safe distance, it may be entertaining to watch the drinker with the middle seat at Kinnick crawl over several bodies while trying not to spill. Whether that's the kind of entertainment that enhances the spilled-upon fans' experience, however, is arguable. Beer and college football are a generations-old marriage, really. Have you ever wondered just how many people would attend games at Kinnick if tailgating with alcohol on campus grounds was altogether forbidden and thoroughly policed? You could have had plenty of personal space in the stadium because the crowds would have been a lot smaller. That doesn't make any difference from concerts or comedy clubs, restaurants, or rodeos. Without fans being allowed to drink close to the stadium, it's fewer customers and less money for the athletic department. That's the bottom line, because Stone Cold Beer said so. Sure, hundreds of thousands of people have been able to sit in Kinnick for 3 hours or more without alcohol over the years, although wouldn't you love to have the price of a stadium beer for every time someone has smuggled booze into an Iowa game? You'd have enough money to fill Kinnick with Dom Perignon. It's interesting how the need to feed the beast slowly and surely changes standards. Selling alcohol at college venues seemed unthinkable for so long. Now, hey, they need the cash. It's like, pardon the term, an addiction. Having regular season college games on any day but Saturday, it went from being taboo to something that's now taken for granted. Iowa has never wanted and still doesn't want night games, not with its Coliseum in a residential area. Feel good about waving to kids in the hospital across the street after the first quarter, but don't expect them to get any sleep until a bellowing crowd has gone away late into the night. But hey, you can't lap up tens of millions of television money each year without your TV overlords telling you when to play your games. Ultimately, everyone always seems to adapt to these changes. It's just football, not anything truly serious, even if the head coach is easily the university's highest-paid employee. Now, don't forget to tip your beer vendors this fall. If you can afford the tickets and the beer, you can share your game day budget with someone besides the school's millionaires. And some local notes in sports. First, in the Central League, the Colonels win the fourth straight in Beloit, Wisconsin. The Cedar Rapids Colonels won their fourth straight game, beating the Beloit Snappers 5-1 last night at Pullman Field. Four pitcher combined to hold the Snappers to five hits and one run while striking out 12. Zach Featherstone struck out five and walked one, less than two innings of relief. Wander Javier led the offense with a two-run home run. Cedar Rapids has already won its first road series 4-1 and closes it out at 2:05 today. The Colonels start a 12-game homestand on Tuesday. In college track and field, the Hawkeyes finished 12th at the NCAAs in Eugene, Oregon. Iowa men's track finished 12th at the NCAA championships this weekend, the program best finish since 1967 when it was 7th. LSU won the team title. On Friday, Jalen McConico was 2nd and Jamal Britt was 4th in the 110 high hurdles. Iowa was also 5th in the 1600 relay. Austin Leitz, Antonio Woodard, Julian Gilliam, and Wayne Lawrence Jr. finished in a season best 3 minutes, 2.54 seconds. I'm just extremely proud of everyone's efforts this entire weekend, Iowa Director of Track and Field Joey Woody said. Iowa senior Lalonga Tosagua finished 2nd in the women's discus Saturday with a throw of 63.53 meters. She was topped by Jorind Van Klinken, a junior from Arizona State, 65.01. Serena Brown, a junior from Iowa, was 10th, 57.06. The silver did make Tosagua a two-event All-American shot put discus. Jenny Kimbrough finished 18th in the heptathlon. The Iowa women finished 26th. USC won the team title. In college football, Purdy and Kohler earned COSITA recognition in Ames. Iowa State's Bach Purdy and Charlie Kohler were named the COSITA Academic All-District 6 football team this week. The team recognized the top athletes for their combined performances on the field and in the classroom. Kohler graduated in the fall with a 3.99 GPA in mechanical engineering. He led all Big 12 tight ends with 44 catches for 591 yards and 7 touchdowns in 2020. Purdy is a two-time Big 12 All-Academic pick. He was Fiesta Bowl MVP and has the most quarterback wins in school history, 23. And in local auto racing, Street Drags Thursday in Cedar Rapids. Hawkeye Street Drags return to Hawkeye Downs Speedway on Thursday. Gates open at 6 p.m., practice starts at 6:30 p.m., and bracket racing begins at 7:30 p.m. All types of vehicles are welcome on the 300-foot drag strip. There is also a show and shine car show. Flipping back to the Insight page, there's a guest column from Brandon Jackson. Brandon Jackson is a founder of Dream Sports and the president of African American Professionals, and he writes about Juneteenth, acknowledging our freedom and history. We live in a country that values history and traditions such as Labor Day, Thanksgiving, Cinco de Mayo, and St. Patrick's Day. Currently, an annual celebration for Juneteenth is unfortunately not a well-known holiday. It's a historical moment in our country's history, and the date June 19th has a strong meaning to many. In 1863, during the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which declared over 3 million slaves living in the Confederate States to be free. However, more than 2 years would pass before the news reached African Americans living in the South. It was not until Union soldiers arrived in Galveston, Texas on June 19, 1865, that the state's residents finally learned that slavery had been abolished. The former slaves immediately began to celebrate with prayer, feasting, song, and dance. The following year, on June 19th, the first official Juneteenth celebrations took place in Texas. We have Christmas for giving, Memorial Day for honoring those who have served, and Juneteenth for celebrating the end of slavery in America. Even with it not being a well-known holiday, it's important to continue to educate our community, young and old, about the day that all Americans became free in the United States. The United States has a deep history with African Americans, but there is an extreme lack of acknowledgement and recognition for celebrations of our culture, such as Juneteenth. With the Emancipation Proclamation only being the beginning of the journey, from Jim Crow laws to the Civil Rights Movement, African Americans still fight for equity and inclusion to this day. On April 11, 2002, then-Governor Tom Vilsack signed legislation establishing Juneteenth as a state holiday in Iowa, known as Juneteenth National Freedom Day, becoming only the 7th state to do so. Here in Cedar Rapids, Mary Bradhart read a proclamation last June 19th declaring the day Juneteenth National Freedom Day. With such great recognition, what will our city plan for with the first year of celebration to support such freedom that many did not have not so long ago? Independence Day symbolizes our country's freedom as Juneteenth symbolizes the end of slavery and beginning of freedom for African Americans, continuing to recognize and support fellow Americans regardless of their age, religion, ethnicity, or race. It's extremely difficult to imagine a world where slavery never ended and freedom never came. There would be no Booker T. Washington, Thurgood Marshall, Madam C.J. Walker, Duke Ellington, Charles R. Drew, Frederick McKinley Jones, Oprah Winfrey, Michael Jordan, Michael Jackson, and the list goes on and on. America's freedom came at a heavy price. Now let's enjoy what those before us established and valued by educating, sharing, and learning with cultural activities such as sports, music, art, dancing, and food. Together, we can support local businesses and Black-owned businesses to show acknowledgement of African-American culture. I challenge you this year and in years to come, in your workplace, in your city, and in your life, to make an effort in taking this holiday into your homes and in your hearts. Mark it on your calendars as a special day, as you do with so many other major holidays and celebrations. Continue this celebration by partnering with local organizations such as the African American Professionals and the African American Museum of Iowa to bring the great city of Cedar Rapids an amazing event year after year. Let's have fireworks for everyone. When we celebrate together, we come together. That was Brandon Jackson, a founder of the Dream Sports and president of African American Professionals. And to that point, we also have a guest editorial from Lanisha Castle, executive director of the African American Museum of Iowa, an opportunity to learn and celebrate. The African American Museum of Iowa is committed to educating Iowa communities authentically and unapologetically. With over 16,000 views of our 2020 virtual week-long Juneteenth celebration, we know we are answering a need across the state to learn all of America's history. As eyes have been opened and consciousness raised, the museum's role in the community has been made clear to more Iowans. While learning about and celebrating Juneteenth has been customary in some places, it isn't generally part of the mainstream classroom curriculum. When did you first learn about Juneteenth? Was it in grade school, college, as an adult, or maybe even today when you picked up the newspaper? Since June 19, 1865, when the last of the United States enslaved people were finally notified of their freedom, Juneteenth has been commemorated annually. In the age-old and ongoing battle about what should be included and excluded in our classrooms, we must ask ourselves, why are we told to remember and never forget some of our nation's biggest historical tragedies and triumphs, but can never talk about, remember, or even teach all of the truths that have permeated our history? Who gets to decide what parts of our American story are more or less palatable or worth authentic inclusion in our textbooks? The African American Museum of Iowa strives to preserve, exhibit, and teach Iowa's African American heritage. We encourage engagement, conversation, and reflection. Convening the types of educational and interactive programs the museum is known for is why audiences come back for more and why our communities continue to see an increase in racial solidarity and the hopeful end to complete silence in the face of inequality, brutality, and injustice. The late poet Maya Angelou said, "Do the best you can until you know better, then when you know better, do better." As we all aspire to do better, the African American Museum of Iowa is here as a resource for all Iowans who want to be proactive in learning history that has long been excluded from our textbooks and oral histories, as well as the impact it has on our society today. It's not too late to engage. You are invited to the African American Museum of Iowa's Celebration of Freedom through education and experience as we kick off our Juneteenth events this Saturday. The museum is collaborating with the African American Youth Think Tank for its first Black History Challenge. The event will be live-streamed from the museum at noon. Three youth teams will compete for cash prizes. On Saturday, our annual festival will be held at Nubo City Market from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. with a mayoral proclamation, all-day stage performances, balloon twisting, community vendor booths, and more. The celebration culminates June 20th with a thought-provoking panel discussion. The event is a collaboration with Cedar Rapids Opera Theater and will delve into the topic, "Does the Color of My Skin Really Matter?" exploring the challenges and opportunities in arts performance for people of color. Moderated by Dr. Myron McReynolds, the panel includes Iowa native and renowned opera singer Dr. Simon Estes. The panel is rounded out with Whitney Morrison, Sydney Outlaw, and Pedro Yanez. Visit blackiowa.org/Juneteenth for links and more information about all the planned activities. That's from Lanisha Castle, Executive Director of the African American Museum of Iowa. And we'll finish today with the Time Machine section, a look back at the people, places, and events in Eastern Iowa, Black Legion Post in Cedar Rapids, World War I Veterans Forum Post in 1919 by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. The American Legion was formed 4 months after the end of World War I. After Congress granted the Legion a national charter in September 1919, posts popped up all over the nation. One of the posts formed in 1919 was in Des Moines, Lincoln Post 126 for the Black Veterans of World War I. Black veterans in Cedar Rapids formed a post in 1920, naming it the Crispus Attucks Post 451, after the Black Native American man who was the first casualty of the American Revolution. One of its first events was a dance with a couple of Des Moines men reporting they had a very enjoyable time with the Parlor City folk. Post 451 struggled from the beginning after many of its members left Cedar Rapids. The post has been practically inactive for several months, the Des Moines-based Iowa Bystander, a newspaper founded in 1894 for Black readers, reported in September. What few members remained were expected to host the state convention September 2nd and 3rd, 1920. When the advance man from Des Moines Lincoln Post arrived in Cedar Rapids, he had difficulty finding anyone from the Crispus Attucks Post. After making a search and after much inquiry, being a total stranger, he finally located the post adjutant in a pool hall, the bystander reported. Informing him of his mission, making it known that there were five others to follow him, he was sent to a questionable place without the adjutant, quitting his interesting pool game. Mrs. Fred Gresham came to the delegate's rescue, opening her home to them and helping them make connections. While the local post seemed dormant, the state convention was held, and more than 1,400 delegates, white and black, made a point of nominating and electing a black delegate, J.Q. Lindsay, to the national convention. In 1925, a group of black veterans in Cedar Rapids sought to reestablish Legion Post 451. They met March 6 at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Butler, 511 9th Avenue Southeast. Alonzo F. Henry was elected commander of the post. O.G. Simmons was vice commander, H.G. Price, adjutant, James Tibbs, chaplain, Jess Anderson, finance officer, and G. Dunlap, sergeant at arms. The group met March 10th and named itself Point de Mousson Post 451 after a city in northeast France that saw ferocious fighting during the war. A week later, Henry was arrested and charged with embezzling money from the newly formed post. Henry was captured at Iowa City 5 minutes after post member H.L. Ragland signed the information charging his superior with embezzlement of the post money, the Gazette reported. According to Ragland, the post commander had been busy since the post was organized March 6, soliciting contributions for the post. The new commander, Paul Tarrington, was elected in April, but the organization petered out, becoming inactive again in 1927. The post reorganized 3 years later and elected Frank J. Walker commander. Other officers were Ivory G. Steele, adjutant, and Dr. W.H. Bashir's finance officer. Post 451 began meeting in the office of the Hanford Post 5 in the Linn County building. The Pont à Mousson Post was among the veterans organizations participating in the dedication of the new Veterans Memorial Building on Mays Island on September 12, 1928. The post began meeting there after the dedication. The last surviving black veteran of the Civil War in Cedar Rapids, Richard Bass, died in January 1929. Veterans from both the Hanford and Pont à Mousson posts attended his funeral. The post drum and bugle corps became a focus of the organization in the 1930s. Benefit boxing tournaments were held in the armory of the Memorial Coliseum to raise funds for equipment for the musicians. The corps also was in demand for Legion parades and other events. Donkey baseball was introduced to Cedar Rapids in 1934, with proceeds from the games going to the Musketeers Drum Corps, the Veterans of Foreign Wars Band, and the Pont à Mousson Drum Corps. In 1937, the Pont à Mousson Post formed an auxiliary. Virgil Powell, a World War I veteran and Cedar Rapids police officer who headed the police department's fingerprint bureau, was elected commander of Post 451 in 1939. He held the post until he retired in September 1946. Not long after that, the Pont à Mousson was absorbed by the Legion's Hanford Post, which disbanded in 2011. And that brings us to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 13, 2021. Reminder that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recordings anytime on our website, iowaradioreading.org. I've been your reader, Sharon Feldudo. Thank you for listening.